Track 1. Western Car Park, Keston Common. What do meat-eating plants, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, a fish named Pet, and Charles Darwin have in common? They have all played a part in Keston's fascinating history, and on this exciting audio trail, you will find out why. During this 2.3-mile trail, you will also discover that humans have helped shape the landscape you see. To this day, many people are still involved in looking after Keston Common, and you will hear from some of them throughout this audio trail. But before we begin, here's some useful information. The audio trail will take you at least 2 hours to complete, and you will need to cross 2 roads during this tour. The second one you cross is particularly busy, so do take great care. We also recommend that you remove your headphones, not only when crossing the road, but also in between each stop, so that you can enjoy the sounds around you. Okay, you are now ready to begin the audio trail. Listen very carefully to the directions guiding you to the next stop, the location of an unlikely place to take a wash.
During this audio trail, I will guide you to your next stop. On some tracks, when I am talking, you will hear this sound. When you do, you may like to pause the audio until you reach where you have been directed. You can then press play again to hear the next directions. This saves you having to remember all the directions in one go. Alternatively, if you have printed off the map and directions, you can use those too. And remember, please feel free to explore the area as you listen to the audio before moving on to your next location. Close to the car park entrance, you will see 20 steps. Head down these and listen to track 2 by the brick-lined stream.
Track 2. Caesar's Well, where ravens helped the Romans and where Darwin got excited about mud. It is here at Caesar's Well, where water is squeezed out from the ground below to create the start or source of the river Ravensbourne. But how did the river and the well get their names? Nick Hopkins and Judy John, who are both countryside officers for the London Borough of Bromley, explain.
The story goes that the Roman army were in the Keston area and they were looking for water, and apparently two ravens were drinking from this area, and the Roman soldiers followed them. And of course these two ravens led them to the source of the water, and therefore it's a bourne, so that's a small river. And ravens were found drinking at the bourne, so hence Ravensbourne. There, and that's the source of the River Ravensbourne, which runs all the way through into Bromley and out towards Deptford and into the Thames.
The spring's been important for a very long time. We've got evidence from the European magazine of 1792 that there was actually a bathhouse here and people used to come and have baths, and that the hill to the south was actually called Coalbath Hill. Later, Victorian microscopists used to come here and also to Keston Bog to look for algae.
The Victorians were mad on collecting almost anything they could get their hands on. And for some, collecting these simple plant-like organisms was a great way to spend their spare time. Charles Darwin often came here and wrote in his most famous book, The Origin of Species, about an experiment he conducted at these ponds.
I do not believe that botanists are aware how charged the mud of ponds is with seeds. I have tried several little experiments, but will here give only the most striking case. I took, in February, 3 tablespoonfuls of mud from 3 different points beneath water on the edge of a little pond. I kept it covered up in my study for 6 months, pulling up and counting each plant as it grew. The plants were of many kinds, and were altogether 537 in number. And yet, the viscid mud was all contained in a breakfast cup.
Now try to imagine how many breakfast cup-sized amounts of mud are in these ponds, and you begin to understand how many hundreds of thousands of seeds must be waiting to germinate. It's time to move on now, and find out what else lurks both below and above these ponds.
Head along the right-hand side of the reservoir and turn left by the first and second ponds. Turn right where many paths cross. Head down 5 steps and listen to track 3 halfway along the left-hand side of the second pond.
Track 3. The Middle Pond. The home of tame fish and white-bellied bats. As you have probably guessed by now, fishing is extremely popular here. Nick Hopkins tells us more.
There are some rudd in there, and roach, tench, pike, which take baby ducklings every now and again, so I'm told. The one that the fishermen get most excited about is the carp. There's some rather large carp in there, probably up to about 15 pounds, something like that, which are quite old fish as well. They can live for a number of years, up to about 30 or 40 years possibly. And the fishermen actually have names for the fish, the carp there. One's called the pet, apparently, because it's so tame that it gets caught all the time and put back.
If you look carefully during the summer, you may see the slender and often brightly coloured bodies of dragonflies and damselflies darting over the ponds. But how do you tell them apart? Local wildlife enthusiast Fred O'Hare reveals.
Normally, dragonflies are larger. At rest, a dragonfly will sit with its wings outstretched at 90 degrees from its body. A damselfly at rest will sit with its wings parallel with its body.
These insects spend most of their life, though, below the water as nymphs, where they feed on water fleas and even small fish.
At the end of their nymph stage, they'll have changed their outer skin 8 to 10 times, until finally, when the conditions are right, temperature-wise, in the water and length of day, they'll emerge. They climb up the vegetation, and then, at the back of the thorax, behind the head, they burst the skin open and the adult emerges.
They then pump up their bodies and wings like a butterfly emerging from a chrysalis before going off for a well-deserved feed. Some bats also like to snack on the bugs that are on offer above the water, and Darwin would have loved thinking about their specially adapted features.
Dor Benton's is a specialist bat over water, and they're adapted to hunt over a water body, because they've got large feet which help them scoop up the insects and bring them up to the mouth so they can be eaten. They've also got a white belly, which you can pick up if you shine a torch across a water body, and you can pick up their white belly. And that may be an adaptation to sort of dazzling insects, possibly.
Continue along the path and carefully cross the road. Head down the steps to the third pond. Follow the path around its edge and listen to track 4 on the bridge.
Track 4. The Bottom Pond, where ninja turtles lurk and royal fishermen hunt.
On the bottom pond, you've got the old ninja turtles, the terrapins that were very popular with the kids when the ninja turtles were on television. Kids got fed up with them, parents probably, or the kids tipped them into the bottom pond, and you can see them there basking on the logs in the sun.
If you look across the pond, there's much more vegetation across there, and there is a tree that actually comes out across the pond, and on that tree you sometimes, if you're lucky, see a kingfisher in the summer that's perching on it looking for fish.
If you look carefully at kingfisher, on the underneath of the bill, the lower part of the mandible, if it's got an orange streak, it's a female. If it hasn't, it's a male. So if you take some binocs along with you, you're lucky enough to see a kingfisher perching. Have a look.
Christine Lloyd is the co-founder of the Friends of Keston group, who volunteer their time to look after this site. And before we move on, she explains that it wasn't just the Romans who drank water from here.
I think it's really fascinating to learn that the ponds aren't ponds, but they're reservoirs, and that they were actually man-made because of the need to have water at Holwood House.
We will discover more about the role this house and its occupants played in ending the slave trade later.
Follow the path along the bottom of the pond and turn left. Follow the path along the right-hand side of the River Ravensbourne and listen to track 5 when you are within 10 metres of the large pair of wooden gates and one metal gate on your right.
Track 5. The River Ravensbourne, where three is company rather than two. If you are here in July or August, you may have spotted the bright pink flowers of the purple loosestrife as you made your way along the edge of the river.
It's a very good nectar source, actually, for invertebrates. Particularly, I remember a time watching a male brimstone butterfly. It was almost drunk on the nectar from these purple loosestrife plants, and we were able to photograph it getting within sort of 5 centimetres of this actual thing, which was amazing.
Charles Darwin, too, got up close and personal with this plant. It was he that discovered that the purple loosestrife actually had a unique and somewhat complex method of reproduction involving three, rather than two, forms of flowers. He was so interested in it that he spent the summers of 1862 and 1863 hand-fertilising the plants, and even wrote a paper called On the Sexual Relations of the Three Forms of Lithrum salicaria, which is its posh scientific name. Of the possible 18 marriages that could be made between the different flowers, Darwin found that only 6 were successful and relied on insects collecting and depositing pollen from the correct flowers. And you thought human relationships were complicated. Just a few metres behind and to your left, you will see a large tree called a black poplar. How old do you think it is? It is sure to have been here when Darwin walked these woods. The tree was planted by the owners of Ravensbourne Lodge, the big flint house that you will soon see on the right. It was from one of its residents that Darwin's daughter received some very useful observations.
Ravensbourne House during Darwin's time was actually lived in or rented for a while by the Bonham Carter family. One of the daughters of the house, Eleanor Bonham Carter, used to write letters to, in fact, Henrietta, but was presumably passed on to her father. And there were some, in fact, that talked about the expressions of her newly born nephew or niece, and also the expression of her dog, which she was describing to Henrietta. And this was just prior to when Darwin was writing the expression of the emotions in man and animals, and we assume that he was providing data for Darwin.
Move on now to find out more about this house.
Continue along the path, cross a small bridge, and listen to track 6 when you reach a small brick wall with the drain.
Track 6, Ornamental Gardens, where the water runs orange and things aren't quite what they seem. The first thing you may notice here is the orange staining running from the drain. This is the result of a high iron content found in the water here, so it's probably best not to have a drink. If you look more closely, you will also notice that this doesn't look like a normal woodland. That's because you are standing in the former garden of Ravensbourne Lodge, which was set in 30 acres, the same as about 24 football or hockey pitches. Large trees, such as the red-barked giant sequoia, some of which are 3,500 years old in their native America, were collected by wealthy Victorians and planted as status symbols.
As you walk along the stream, you'll notice it's got sort of concrete and stone base. It's almost and ornamentally done so that the water runs over it. And there's more pampas grass along here and bamboo and the great giant sequoia. In Victorian times, it's likely that it was put there deliberately and it was quite a pretty walk for people going through. But the Victorians quite like to leave some of the natural planting. So as you walk along, you will notice in the spring there's wood anemones on the left of the bank. There are some nice ferns. Some of those ferns are probably quite natural. Others might have been brought in. And there's certainly liverworts in the stream too, if you look along the banks.
From here, turn right. Ignore both the path with the bridge over the river in front of you and another left-hand turn with a bridge after 90 metres. Instead, continue ahead and take the next left-hand turn, which cuts back on itself a further 150 metres ahead. Listen to track 7 when you reach the bridge.
Track 7, Padmore Wood, where the trees have many trunks.
Padmore Woods is a very ancient wood. It's got a really beautiful ancient woodland flora with some quite rare plants in it. The first time we actually hear of it called Padmore was a map of 1484, which talks about a mill. And the Old English pad means toad. It's Old English for toad.
Whilst no one is sure, it is believed the mill was water-powered and used to grind corn. What we can be sure of, though, is that coppicing took place here. Did you notice the quite large stem trees sprouting up from each base or stool? When Charles Darwin used to walk these woods, he would have no doubt encountered the woodsman responsible for these, although the woods would have looked quite different then. Judy and Nick provide a glimpse into the life of these men.
The sweet chestnut coppice at Padmore is very ancient. If you look, some of the coppice stools, which is where the coppice has been cut down to ground level, are very, very wide at the base, so it's been coppiced for many hundreds of years, and they were cut in rotation. There were areas called coops or falls.
They would have set up these sort of camps, I suppose, where they would have worked the wood and they would have processed the wood in situation. It wouldn't have been removed from site. It would have been cut, bark would have been removed, and then they would have cleaved, what they call cleaved it, into workable products. So whether that was fencing, making hurdles for local farmers to keep livestock in. And then that would have been taken off-site at some point, probably by horse and cart, and sold on to local landowners, straight farmers.
There are also some charcoal hearths at Padmore, so we know that some of the wood was probably turned into charcoal, which was, of course, used as fuel.
Believe it or not, these woodsmen could have been found in the woods right up until the Second World War. Would you fancy spending most of your life in a tent in the woods? In the 1990s, staff and volunteers resurrected the art of coppicing for another reason.
They wanted to start to manage it for a different aspect for wildlife conservation, because when the chaps were coppicing in the 18th, 19th and early 20th centuries, the wildlife aspect of it was really a byproduct. It was the wood that they wanted. And the fact that the woodland was managed in that way actually encouraged wildlife. But what we're doing now was actually bring coppicing back for the wildlife angle. And we did get a little bit of money back from it. And we actually have this year used our own chestnut coppice products in the post and rail fencing on Hayes and Keston.
With this talk of money in mind, let's move on now and make a visit to the bank.
Turn left. On reaching the T-junction, turn right and listen to track 8 by the concrete marker post with the number 11 painted on it, 70 metres further on.
Track 8. Wood bank. Where young trees rather than money are saved. To your right is a wood bank. Okay, so you won't get any money from this one, but for the woodsmen, it kept their valuable crop of young coppice shoots away from the prying eyes and mouths of animals that would have grazed over most of this site. A ditch on the outside edge of the woodland would have provided the stone and mud that would have originally made the bank much higher. And just to make sure, a hedge would have been planted on top to stop the pesky sheep and cows from getting a tasty snack. In the next trek, you'll discover why the length of a bee's tongue is so important.
Follow the path through the wood and take the right-hand path where it forks by marker post 12. Head towards the standing dead tree and listen to track 9 in the middle of the meadow.
Track 9. Dry meadow, where size matters and nature needs a helping hand. Charles Darwin loved meadows because they contained many hundreds of plants and insects. This allowed him to study and observe their interactions.
If you look at a clover flower, either a red or a white one, you'll find that the actual flower isn't really a flower at all, but it's a flower head made up of lots of little flowers. And if you pick a white clover and you pick a red clover, just the one tiny flower from the head, you'll see that red clovers are twice as long as white clovers. And Darwin looked at red clover and he saw how much longer they were than the others, and he thought, well, you're going to need a bee with a long tongue to pollinate this. And he found that bumblebees were the only things that could pollinate it, and it needed long-tongued bumblebees as well, not just any bumblebee. He also tried looking at clover and seeing how it would, if you excluded all the bees, whether it would produce viable seed. And he found that actually the red clover, when he had nets over it, The stuff with nets over produced practically no viable seed. The stuff that was unnetted would produce sort of 2,700, I think he counted.
So clearly, in the world of bees and clover, size really does matter. Remember how animals used to graze across Keston? Well, here there were no banks or hedges to stop them eating the grass, and this ensured that a wide variety of plants could grow, which was great for biodiversity. When grazing stopped around the time of the Second World War, tractors took their place.
The tractor comes in, cuts it, the grass is left for a day or two, then it's turned, and the reason being is that hopefully the seeds from all the wildflowers drop out, and then the grass has to be taken away, so that's why it's baled. If it wasn't, and it was just allowed to rot into the ground, it would encourage all the competitive grasses, which they end up sort of not allowing wildflowers to grow because they're too robust, really.
The woodland edges have to be managed too. With no livestock to munch the trees and shrubs, these plants themselves eat away at the grassland as they slowly spread into the open spaces. A gentle height gradient called an ecotome is created between the meadow and the woodland for the benefit of the wildlife.
And that's really to allow things like invertebrates to warm up. You get a lot, obviously the dragonflies have to warm up and that you get on the ponds. And they like a structure. So, you know, some bare ground is great because that obviously warms up a lot quicker. And then as the sun comes up, you know, you need a structure of grass and then scrub for them to rest on, to feed on.
Continue along the path towards the dead tree and follow it as it bears left. Ignore the first path on your right and continue past three tall Lombardy poplar trees. You will notice another path running parallel to your right with wooden barriers. Continue downhill and listen to track 10 when these paths meet again a further 50 metres ahead.
Track 10, Wet Meadow. Watch out for Granny's toenails. Now, the areas to your left and right may look the same as the dry meadow in the last stop, but this is in fact a wet meadow.
The wet meadows are lovely because you've got some things in there that you don't find elsewhere. Wet hay meadows are something that's decreasing a lot in the UK, but if you look across at the right time of year, in March you've got the bright gold of the kingcups, and some quite close to the bridleway as well. In June you'll see the pink of the ragged robin across in the corner. The birdsfoot trefoil that grows in the wet meadows is one associated with wet areas. In fact, Darwin looked at it, and it's at night it has sleep movements where it brings its leaflets up against the stem, which helps to protect it from water loss in the colder days.
The birdsfoot trefoil is also known by many other names, including bacon and eggs, because of the rich yolk yellow flowers that are often streaked with red. Names such as Dutchman's clogs and lady's slippers give you an idea of the flower's shape. It grows close to the ground and is a member of the pea family. The long seed pods it produces look like claws and have the less flattering names of granny's toenails and devil's fingers. Speaking of the devil, in track 11 you'll hear tales of poison and murder.
Turn right, cross the wet meadow and listen to track 11 next to the wooden gate by the woodland.
Track 11, tales of poison and murder on the woodland edge. To your right, below the large oak trees, there is ongoing work to cut back a shrub called cherry laurel. If you recall, the Victorians liked to collect new and interesting plant species, and this one provided good cover for game birds such as pheasant, which they liked to shoot. Left unmanaged, and the waxy green leaves of these quick-growing shrubs block out light, casting shade on footpaths. But they hide an even darker secret.
Unfortunately, now it gives us a conservation problem because it's full of cyanide in the leaves, and of course what it does is it creates a little habitat for itself by poisoning the soil with the cyanide. So it doesn't allow anything else to compete against it. So it essentially propagates the soil for itself.
These days, now that the seasons are getting much longer, it not only flowers, but it also sets seed, which is something it didn't do in Victorian times. And now it sets seeds, we're finding little seedlings everywhere. The Victorians did know about the cyanide, however, and they did, and when they were catching butterflies and moths to pin out for collections, they would put a butterfly in a jar with a couple of leaves that had been cut, and the cyanide was sufficient to kill them.
But it's not just the butterflies that should be wary.
As part of removing it, sometimes we've had volunteers doing the cutting, and they've cut down the wood, and you need to wear gloves when you're cutting down this wood, because there are chemicals within the wood which are quite toxic. Some people are sensitive to these, and it'll make your hands swell up, and if, of course, you touch anything when you've got your hands contaminated with this sort of fluid, then that bit'll swell up too.
On that bombshell, let's keep our hands to ourselves and make our way to the next stop to find out about one of Darwin's most astounding discoveries, meat-eating plants.
Walk past the gate. Turn left, and after 50 metres, turn right through the pine woodland. Listen to track 12, approximately 50 metres further on.
Track 12. Keston Bog. Where meat-eating plants once lived.
Keston Bog, or to give it its official name, is Lowland Valley Mire. It's a site of special scientific interest, and the reason that it's notified is that it has quite a few uncommon plants that we don't really find anywhere else in London, and definitely not in Bromley context.
And it was one of these uncommon plants that led Charles Darwin to a shocking discovery, firstly in Hartfield, Sussex, and then here at the open area on your right.
During the summer of 1860, I was surprised by finding how large a number of insects were caught by the leaves of the common sundew. On one large leaf, I found the remains of 13 distinct insects.
Sundew, or Drosera, to give it its posh scientific or Latin name, caught insects using a sticky substance on its leaves, which then wrapped around its prey.
The leaf being thus converted into a temporary cup, or stomach.
His studies revealed that the leaves then produced an acid that helps digest the unlucky prey. But he couldn't quite believe it. Had Darwin discovered meat-eating plants?
I will. And must finish my Drosera manuscript, which will take me a week, for at this moment I care more about Drosera than the origin of all the species in the world. But I will not publish on Drosera till next year, for I am frightened and astounded at my results.
Darwin enthusiastically set about testing the plant's digestive abilities, and in addition to meat and vegetables, he tried things like
3 cubes of extremely tough cartilage, from the end of a slightly roasted leg bone of a sheep, moderately sized bits of the skinned ear of a cat,
and
some thin transverse slices of the canine tooth of a dog.
He even tested human urine, mucus, and saliva, and to his surprise, the plants digested all of them. However, even sundews draw the line at some things.
These unexciting and indigestible substances are, as far as I have observed, bits of human nails, balls of hair, the quills of feathers, fat, oil, starch.
Darwin went on to publish a book in 1875 called Insectivorous Plants, where he noted that the sundew preferred conditions with lots of water and few nutrients or food, the nutrients instead coming from insects, and also cat's ears when Mr. Darwin was around. Since Darwin's time, the sundew has become extinct here. The building of a housing estate and the planting of the trees around the bog after the World Wars has affected the sundew's habitat. Trees have both increased the nutrients found in the soil and reduce the amount of water here by sucking up the water for their own needs. However, it is hoped with careful management over the coming years, the plant may be introduced again.
Continue ahead, ignoring paths to the left and right, and safely cross over to the other side of the road after 100 metres. Turn left onto the main footpath and follow this back towards the second pond you passed near the start. Listen to track 13 by the large rectangular log that serves as a bench before you reach the pond.
Track 13, Heathland, where the trees grow sideways. Why not have a bit of a rest? Perhaps you might see a darting dragonfly patrolling the area by the pond. Or you may like to imagine what the scene would have looked like in the late 1800s, when Victorians in their finery came here from London to take afternoon tea. During this period, there would have been far fewer trees, and instead of grasses, purple-flowered heather would have been the most common plant. And you can still see some if you look carefully, but it only flowers in August. Heather likes dry, well-drained soils, but when grazing stopped here, around the time of the Second World War, there was nothing to munch the trees, and so more and more grew. The shade these trees cast meant the heather found it more difficult to grow, but the trees struggled too.
So if you look at the plants on the top of the heathland, some of them are very stunted. You've got very stunted pine trees, you've got poor thin grasses. So it's quite interesting in its own way, because you'll get different grasses growing on there that you've found in other parts of the site as you walk around the trail.
As you make your way to the next stop, you will see there is almost no soil in some places, and the ground almost looks like concrete. Because the soil is so thin and contains little food, one tree in particular has stopped growing upwards and now grows sideways. Good reason if ever you needed one to make sure you eat your greens.
When you are ready, take the nearest of two paths by the bench that heads into an open grassy area on the right. Continue uphill for approximately 100 metres, ignoring small paths to the right, and head into a second grassy area. Turn left by a forked pine tree into woodland, and then right onto the main path. Listen to track 14, where this path crosses a small mound approximately 25 metres ahead.
Track 14. Ice, wild boars and earthworks. 18,000 years in 2 minutes. Travel back 18,000 years and you would have probably been wrapped in a furry animal skin and struggling to stop your teeth chattering. That is because Keston Common was a large, barren, Arctic landscape. Over the following 8,000 years, the planet warmed. Yes, they too had climate change. And slowly plants began to grow until this whole area would have been covered in forest. It would be another 4,000 years, though, before the first humans started coming here, feeding mainly on nuts and berries, but also hunting wild boar and deer. These were clever people. Rather than chasing these animals around the forest like headless chickens, they cleared small areas of woodland for the animals to graze in and then pounced on them with spears and other weapons. Keston Common itself remained pretty much unchanged until 200 years BC. This was the Iron Age. Nick Hopkins tells us more.
People were starting to move away from the hunter-gatherer lifestyle and move into sort of farmsteads and protective earth and bank systems. So it's interesting that they chose one of the highest points to site that ditch and bank system.
You are actually standing on one of those banks now. Although in the Iron Age this would have been much taller, and just like the wood bank we saw earlier, there would have been a big ditch in front to stop unwelcome visitors. We don't really know the purpose of this place, but it covered an area roughly the same as 34 football or hockey pitches. Imagine how long it would have taken to build that.
Continue straight on into the open heathy area and past the Keston Common panel. Ignore the path on the left and continue along the path and turn left at the T junction. Safely cross the road onto the path opposite. Head along the path for 5 to 10 minutes. Listen to track 15 by the stone bench on your left.
Track 15. Wilberforce Tree, where the end of slavery is rooted in history. Not far behind the trees to your left is a mansion called Holwood House. It was built in the 1820s on the site of an earlier building owned by the youngest ever Prime Minister, William Pitt, who came to power aged 24. It was right here, under the shade of a large oak tree, that Pitt had a conversation with fellow politician William Wilberforce that would lead to the end of the slave trade. It took Wilberforce another 20 years for his dream to become reality and end the so-called triangular route. This was the trade that took British goods to Africa, and the money raised was used to buy slaves. These men, women and children were then sent to the West Indies to produce tobacco, sugar and cotton. They were in turn sold by the British for great profit. It is estimated that 1.4 million Africans were killed on the transportation ships alone. Charles Darwin hated slavery and saw at first hand the horrors of this trade during his trip to South America on the HMS Beagle.
On the 19th of August, we finally left the shores of Brazil. I thank God I shall never again visit a slave country. To this day, if I hear a distant scream, it recalls with painful vividness my feelings when passing a house near Pernambuco. I heard the most pitiable moans, and could not but suspect that some poor slave was being tortured. Those who look tenderly at the slave owner, and with a cold heart at the slave, never seem to put themselves into the position of the latter. What a cheerless prospect, with not even a hope of change. Picture to yourself a chance ever hanging over you of your wife and your little children, those objects which nature urges even the slave to call his own, being torn from you and sold like beasts to the first bidder.
Whilst the Wilberforce oak under which Wilberforce and Pitt talked has now died, the stone bench to your left and a new tree to your right commemorate this momentous piece of history. Let's now leave William Pitt and instead travel even further back in time to discover a different kind of Pitt.
Return back the way you came. Once you have safely crossed the road and taken the first right, listen to track 16, the final track, as you follow this path back to the car park.
Track 16. Gravel Pits. The end. Or is that the start of the road? Remember how we went back 18,000 years at the Iron Age earthworks? Well, that's nothing compared to the 60 million years that it took to form the flint pebbles you see exposed here. In Darwin's day, these stones were extracted to build roads. There are some interesting plants found here, as Judy explains.
There's quite a few mosses on the right as you go down, and different sorts you can look at. One that's very pretty, I think it's called Dicranella, and it's got quite sort of wavy, curvy little leaflets you can have a look at.
So we have now come to the end of this Audio Trails production, and no doubt you know a little more about the place where meat-eating plants and wild boar once lived, where the end of slavery began, and where Charles Darwin sloshed in ponds, squelched in bogs, and sunned himself on heaths. If you would like to discover more about Charles Darwin and the local area he called home, then visit darwinatdown.co.uk and audiotrails.co.uk for more information and downloads. You may like to volunteer your time to help look after Keston Common. No experience is necessary, and you are always welcome. Call the Rangers on 01689 862 815. Have a safe journey home. Goodbye.